Where's your favorite place to be a weekender or tourist?
Ooh, that's a good one. I would say now I think it's Whitefish. You know, if I get a chance to get out of town, I want it to mean something, so I'll take the 3 hours and get up there.
And Whitefish is in the northwest corner of Montana near Glacier Park?
Yes.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Erin Saldine about her young adult novel, The Dead Enders, a book set in the fictional resort town of Gold Fork. The book is about a group of four high school students in the tourist town of Gold Fork, brought together by tragedy. It takes place over the course of a summer, and from the very beginning, you set up the insider-outsider dynamic. And there are the weekenders, the tourists, who squeal things like, I can't believe you get to live here, and I'd live here forever if I could. So what does it mean to grow up and live year-round in a tourist destination?
Well, I didn't actually grow up in a tourist town, but I grew up going to one every summer, not exactly as a tourist. Most of my friends were the weekenders, I guess, and they would go from Boise to this little lakeside town of McCall, and they all had cabins there, and they would go out on their boats and have parties every night. And I, meanwhile, would go to camp and work at these summer camps, and sometimes they'd come pick me up and take me out water skiing and tell me about the parties and drop me off again. So I had a kind of, I never quite fit in with the weekenders themselves, though that would be, I think, the group with which I was more closely aligned through friendship. But then I got to know a lot of people who lived in McCall because I was there all summer and going in for supplies and things like that, going into town. I would actually get to know people who lived there year-round.
So the book is also a young adult novel, and from the get-go, you let readers know that this is not a fantasy. There will be no spells, no dragons, no time travel. What was the importance of that declaration?
I think that was in part maybe a little wink toward young adult readers.
Yeah.
I don't read a lot of fantasy literature, and specifically not YA fantasy. But a lot of my students at the University of Montana who are studying creative writing live in that world of fantasy writing, and it's a complex and dynamic and very valid literary world. But that's not the area I'm writing in, and I kind of wanted to speak to that right off the bat as kind of the author. But I also wanted to speak to the idea that when you go to a resort town like Gold Fork, as I imagined it, you do have a sense upon entering that town, like anything is possible. It's kind of a magical realm. You can do anything. You can be a different person. Anything you want is yours for the taking, perhaps. And from the perspective of the voice that was writing that portion of the book in which they said there are no spells here, that's just not the case. So for the kids who live there, they don't feel necessarily like anything is possible. They have these brief moments where they see it from the perspective of the weekenders, but they don't necessarily live year-round in this kind of magical realm that the weekenders are seeing every time they get out of their fancy cars.
And the group of kids that live there year-round are called the Dead Enders, which is also the title of the book.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you'll just jump in and read a little section about who they are.
Sure. So this is part of a section told from this kind of collective first-person voice in which that voice is describing all of the different groups of people that you can find in this tourist town in the summer. Dead enders, and the dead enders are the ones who live there year-round. Dead enders. Have-nots, never-wills, do-nothings, go-nowheres. Dead enders don't summer, they don't weekend. They spend their summer vacation at home wearing last year's swimsuits, last year's shorts. They're not all poor. A few of them may even live on the lake full-time, lending them an uncomfortable dockside-slash-dead-ender status. But for them, summer in Gold Fork is another hot summer at home, And why would you buy a new swimsuit for that? We didn't come up with the name, obviously. That honor goes to a weekender mother who was talking too loudly on her cell while she waited for her progeny to get their lattes at Granny's. "I just can't even," she said. "I mean, it's heartbreaking to see. These kids here, the year-rounders, they're just..." And we held our breath, knowing that whatever she said next would be ours, that we'd take it and use it like a weapon we chose. On a dead-end street. That's the thing with weekenders. They're always giving us gifts, whether they know it or not. But dead-enders know things about Gold Fork that genus weekendus never will. They know how to get to the cliffs by Washer's Landing without using the main road, where to find mushrooms of both salad topping and hallucinogenic varieties the year after a forest fire, why the high school is painted that gaudy orange, why Granny's espresso is better on Tuesday than Sunday. Trivial things that nevertheless mean you live somewhere. You're not just a visitor. You may hate it here 8 months a year, maybe planning on leaving and never looking back, except we whisper to ourselves, low enough so no one else hears, maybe on the weekends. But at least you know it, and that's something, right?
So there's something a bit breakfast clubby about the four central characters, Anna, Davis, Eric, and Georgie. Can you just describe each of them in detail?
Sure. I actually was thinking of the Breakfast Club as I wrote the book, because that was such an important movie as I was growing up. I'll start with Davis, who is, he's an interesting character because his family does live on the lake year-round. And he's also a character who enjoys quite a bit of privilege in the book as well. His parents are married. They're both employed. And he has, you know, a bright future ahead of him. He'll be leaving to go to college, and he knows it, and everybody around him knows it. And so I think that puts him in a special position within the group of friends as having an avenue out of town, which allows him to take that avenue for granted. He doesn't necessarily feel trapped in the way that everybody else does. So that's one character. Uh-huh. His closest friend, I think, is Anna, who is the daughter of a single mother. Anna is Latina and lives a little bit outside of town. And she is a very private person. She's the most private character of the four. I think partly in response to the fact that she feels rather alone. But she has reached out to an older lady that she visits as part of her job and at a nursing home. And she and this woman have a really strong bond that then kind of leads itself into some mysteries in the novel that the other characters wouldn't be in a position to have perspective on, that she's able to have a special perspective on some of these dramas in the book that other people can't have because of her relationship with this older woman. So she's found a way to get that kind of family relationship through that tie to the woman in the nursing home. And then there's Georgie, who is, she's kind of an interesting character. She was a lot of fun to write because she knows exactly what she wants. She's a musician and she wants to take her band and get to the city and get out of town. And she knows that she doesn't have enough money. Her parents don't have enough money to pay for college. And she doesn't care about college anyway because she wants to be a musician. So she has quite a lucrative drug dealing business. And it's at its height, of course, every summer. So she's finding herself in different situations throughout the summer that have to do primarily with her work and her desire, perhaps, as the book progresses, to get out of that work. It becomes a little bit more dangerous than she initially thought it would be. And she might have a little love interest in there as well.
It wouldn't be summer without it.
Right, exactly. And then the fourth character is Eric, who was, I think, the most difficult character to write for me, but ended up being my favorite character. And like Anna, he lives in a single-parent household and has, while Anna has, I think, a complicated but good relationship with her mother, Eric's relationship with his mother is really difficult and challenging. And I think his mother perhaps has kind of an undiagnosed mental illness, which makes it hard for Eric, who is kind of the athlete and superstar in town. All the ladies love him. And I think he has this sense of being trapped in the town more than anybody else does, not only because he doesn't necessarily see an easy way out for himself, but because he also sees how he'll be trapped by his mother forever. So he has a more complex psychology, I think, than the other characters necessarily.
I'm glad you brought up the point of connection and relationships, because after I finished the book, I went back and thought, I just read a compelling book about a nursing home, you know? And there's also a drug lord. And how, I was thinking, Aaron, how did you manage to put that in there and make it interesting? You know, I'm assuming that your young adult readers are responding positively to it. How did you know you could do that?
Well, it's actually very funny. Initially, this book was a book about a nursing home. When I started it years ago, I had about 80 pages of this YA novel set in a nursing home, about a nursing home, with actually very few young adult characters in it. And it was a joy for me to write all 80 pages because I love nursing homes and I have spent a lot of time in them, and I find a lot of joy in spending time with the elderly and hearing their stories and being in that kind of strange world that is not a world that fits into their previous lives at all. Right? Once you enter that space, you're entering a different, I think, kind of a different life for yourself. So I've always really enjoyed that. But I got about 80 pages in, and it became very clear that the book could only go so far. There is an inevitable end in a nursing home novel. And also, my editor at the time said, I'm not sure that your readers are really going to be excited about a book that takes place entirely in a nursing home.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Erin Saldine about her young adult novel, The Dead Enders. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In this second half, we'll be covering some more delicate topics, including suicide. Listener discretion is advised. In spite of all the unruly behavior, like the crime and mystery and sex even, mm-hmm. there is this sense of a moral thread, mm-hmm. like a light guidance to the youth of America. And how did you walk the line between being overly rebellious and just like chaotic and mm-hmm. being kind of like goody two-shoes?
That's a really hard line for me to walk, and it's been something that's been, I would say, I've had the most learning in as I've entered writing YA and moving away from writing adult literature. I think with my first book, when I initially wrote it, it had an ending that was just devastating. And my editor acquired it, and then she said very kindly to me, you cannot end the book this way. Your readers can't handle this kind of devastation. And I said, well, that's consequences, you know. That's what happens in real life. And she said, yeah, but that's not what happens in young adult literature. So I think for me, it's been a struggle to find ways to have the characters learn things, as we all do in real life, but have them do so in a realistic way. So if there is a moral thread, I hope it's one that feels realistic instead of impressed upon the reader.
I want to come back to the tone of the book, but mm-hmm. before that, the other thing that struck me was, you know, by page 400, I felt like I could anticipate the interactions between the characters. And so I was thinking, you know, that you are juggling a lot of different balls in the air in terms of you have four characters who are constantly negotiating relationships with each other and their parents and these weekenders. Mm-hmm. How did you both fully inhabit each voice and then do like cross dialogue?
It was not quite as difficult as I thought it would be. My writing process includes a lot of just free writing. And so even at the end of this very long revision process, I still give myself the chance to sit down and just write, kind of free write from one character's perspective. And sometimes entire scenes would come out of that that hadn't been in the book at all months before it went into publication. But I still felt like that was useful because it allowed me to reconnect to those voices. Before I started any section, I would reread the previous section from that character's voice to myself, usually out loud, in order to reconnect to that as well. And then when they were in scenes with one another, it felt I knew what I wanted from them and between them. And as I was writing, it was really interesting to watch which characters I would put into conversation with one another. For instance, it was really interesting to me that Anna and Davis were often having these kind of very blunt conversations about what they thought, whereas Georgie and Eric, I think, were still, as friends, hiding information from one another whenever they spoke. And then, you know, Davis and Eric hardly ever spoke. And Georgie and Anna did. They spoke sometimes, but not that much with one another, which was something that actually made me a little uncomfortable for a while because I thought, well, why can't these two female characters speak to one another? So I wanted to be true to those characters in the way that they interacted with one another. But it was sort of that process by which you're, you know, noticing things about your characters and feeling shocked by it or disappointed by their limitations, which, you know, one could say, well, those are your limitations, right? You're the author. But I really felt like these were real people who were able to connect with some people and unable to connect with others.
I wanted to point out that the book is in five different points of view, right? Mm-hmm. For each of the four characters. That's part of why I was like, how did you keep the rotation going? And then there's this fifth collective voice, which you mentioned. And there's this sense of contempt and kind of anger in that fifth collective voice, this chorus that comes back and back and back. And some of the examples of the titles of these different choruses are Where the Summer Begins, Where the Lake Is All Yours, Where There Are No Excuses, Where There's Nothing to Lose, Where Adventure Awaits. And I was hoping that you could read the section called Where You Get What You Want When You Want It.
Where you get what you want when you want it. We take what we can, from the weekenders, sure, but also from the town, the land, ourselves, other dead-enders. We take unchained bicycles, sex, peppermint patties, forgotten sweaters, firewood, friendship. We take what we can because we know that we don't have time to waste. If we want it, we want it now. If we need it, we have to take it. And once we have it, we hold it close, knowing that we could lose it at any moment. Wildfire. Avalanche, recession, guilt. In this place, everything is both a gift and a weapon. Our only hope lies in knowing what can wound us.
I was just at a writing retreat and got to hear the voices of young writers and poets. And when I read that passage, I was thinking, are the teens of America thinking about recession? And what I realized is, yeah, they're actually like really tuned in to how the adults are screwing up.
Right.
But I wanted to know about your process of taking on a teen voice and letting yourself like fill with the Plutonian energy of anger and destruction and honesty.
Right. Those were my favorite sections to write. And I think many of them were the first things I wrote once I had settled on kind of what this book was going to be about. And once I realized where it was going to be set, then this voice emerged really quickly. It emerged, I think, because I spend a lot of time thinking about that teenage experience of knowing yourself to be an individual and knowing that in a way that you never know it again. and yet constantly checking yourself against the collective and having that identity challenged by the collective, or finding out, realizing how much that sort of collective identity has actually influenced the identity that you thought was so authentically your own. And that, to me, was kind of the central question as I approached this book. How do we know ourselves without our community? And I don't think we do, obviously. So as I was writing it, I thought these are some kids who live in a town that is affected by very adult things, development, recession. The economy of this town influences the kids who live there in a way that I think many children are sheltered from in different areas. And so they do have opinions about it. They do have anger. They absorb the anger of their parents' social group as well. And they share that with one another. They talk about it. I mean, they're not sitting around talking about taxes.
Right.
But they are talking about what it's like to be there. And they see and feel that disparity between themselves and the weekenders on so many different levels. So it was very easy, I think, to channel that in this sort of collective voice, because that, I think, would be the place where they all would find the most similarity, how they're responding to these external influences that influence the town and the land and their parents and them and themselves.
One of the other serious topics that comes up in the book is suicide. And in the back of the book, you offer, you know, suicide prevention resources and support resources. And it got me thinking about, you know, the show 13 Reasons Why, I know, has had a huge impact on the dialogue around
right. What's
appropriate, safe, and what has integrity.
Right.
And I was just wondering, Erin, how did you figure out that line, again, of how to talk about something that's real and not glorify it?
Right. That was really difficult. And I've had some strong opinions to that TV show, some strong reactions. I think it's very easy to glorify it. And I think that it plays such a prominent role in so much YA literature. But I think the more important question is why it does. And I think it does because it's something so many kids think about. If they don't actually act on it, they are thinking about it. And it's worked its way into the conversation to the degree that I think it's worked its way into people's internal conversation. I don't want to give anything away about the book. There were two things that I thought about, though, as I was writing that scene in the aftermath. And one was that I actually wanted there to be just a bit of a question, just a glimmer of hope. And I don't think that people have read that as being there, but as I wrote it, it was there in my mind. So that was one thing. I did want there to be just this question mark. And then the other thing that I thought about was how I wanted to focus on, you know, when there is suicide, what is the aftermath? And it's not pretty, and it's not glorified, and it's not easy. I think in the thing that I resist the most in YA literature, and that I think the best YA literature does not do at all, is when things are kind of tied up neatly in a bow. I think you can have a moral thread in a book and still not tie it all up and say, the end. Mm-hmm. Here you go. All is saved. And I didn't want that. I wanted it to be messy because it is a messy world that I'm creating or reflecting.
As an older reader reading a YA novel, mm-hmm. one of the things that helped me was these references to music. Mm-hmm. There's Neil Young and some sort of classic indie rock references.
Right.
And I was wondering why you felt like you needed to put nods to, you know, to those of us who might have some kind of grounding.
Oh, that's so funny. Sadly, those were not nods. Those were me refusing to reflect the music of
young adult readers. There's no Taylor Swift.
There's no, what's she called? Tay-Tay?
Tay-Tay, yeah.
There's no Tay-Tay. My editor actually said there are so many interesting and hilarious blog posts by YA readers about the fact that these adult YA authors refuse to use like young contemporary musicians in their books. They just keep going back to Neil Young or Nico Case, or we think we're being hip when we use, I don't know, Band of Horses or something. Right. And then your readers are still like, no.
Right. Part of me was thinking either it's a way to sort of preserve this in, you know, in glass, because we already know what the classics were from the 90s, you know, or if it was a way to nudge the readers, like, here's the good stuff. You
know? I have something backwards for you to go look for. No, actually, I think it for Georgie, who is the musician, she's so heavily influenced by punk, you know, but also by Nirvana and the music that I, of course, listened to when I was Georgie's age. But I do think that that happens, right? And I'm at the university. I know a lot of my students are listening to Nirvana. And, you know, I would kind of ask them. I'd kind of crowdsource, is this really lame? And they'd say, maybe. But also, oh, no, I listened to it. Or they did turn me away from certain musicians.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you write, you think you own this place, but you don't. We don't either. It owns us. Erin, what's a place that owns you?
I would say McCall, Idaho does own me, where I really set the book, though I created a fictional town around it. That's the place that I grew up spending almost all of my summers from probably age 7 until age 19 as a Girl Scout camper and then as a counselor at a different camp and then now as an adult going back there as a weekender. I've fully embraced my weekender status. I think that's a place that I just, a good deal of this book was written while I was in McCall, and it just continues to inspire me whenever I'm there.
Erin Saldine lives in Missoula, Montana, where she credits her husband and team of childcare providers for allowing her to write. She teaches at the Davidson Honors College at the University of Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.